Anyway, okay, today is November 26th, and we're learning, it's called an overdose of spirituality. So first that review we talked about. So at the top of the sheet, I just listed the subjects we've seen. Let's just remember them. We saw the commandment to keep the Passover, and remember the verses that say that command was spoken on the first day of the first month of the second year. So that's really the beginning of the book of Numbers, even though it appears in chapter 9. Things are slightly out of order. It begins there, and it says to keep the Passover on the 14th of the month at eventide. And then we have there the story of those who couldn't do it because they were ritually impure, and they got a second date.
Hi.
Good evening. They got a second chance, and they're going to keep it on the 15th of the second month of the second year. Which means that here in this one commandment, we're spanning a month and a half. It's given on the first day of the first month of the second year, and it goes all the way to the keeping of the second Passover, which is in the 15th of the second month of the second year. So that's a month and a half. And that month and a half span really is the month and a half that the first 9 chapters of this book, the first 10 chapters, take place in. That month and a half. The second thing we saw was the gift of oxen and wagons to the tabernacle, which was there in chapter 8, I think. Was it in 8 or was it in... No, it was back in chapter 7. And that was on the first day of the second month. Of Todd, do you have a text there? No, in your iPad?
From what?
For the Torah, do you have there?
Yeah, I can look it up.
I'm saying if you have it, then your book can be used by Fred?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Is that okay?
Use my book. Sure.
Okay. So that was the first day of the second month of the second year. And remember, that was about the equipment they needed to carry the tabernacle through the desert. Then we had the 12-day ceremony of gifts to the chieftains, which begins on the first day of the second month and goes for 12 days. We had the census of the tribes, which seems to be at the very beginning of the first month, right? All this is happening at the same time. The census of the Levites and the firstborn, and we interchange one with the other, remember? And all of these things about preparation for the journey to the land of Israel. Then we had the appointment of the Levites to carry their tasks, carry the different pieces of the tabernacle through the desert, and the arrangement of the camp for the journey. All of these happened, we said, in the first month and a half. Of course, we saw two matters in these 9 or 10 chapters that were beyond chronology, the matter of the Nazir and the matter of the rebellious wife or the wayward wife. They didn't have any dates in them. We don't really understand how they're related to this particular time period. They were there also. So those are the things we talked about for the first 6 classes. Now we're going to begin the journey. Right now we're beginning the journey. Everyone have their ticket? So let's just look at some material. Chapter 9, verse 15. We haven't seen this yet, I think. Just going to realize it's here. Now, if it's too hard for you to work with the...
Numbers?
Yeah.
Chapter 9, 16?
9, 15.
Gotcha.
Can you find it in that Tanakh? So 9, 15. On the day that the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the pact, and in the evening it rested over the tabernacle in the likeness of fire until morning. That's a paraphrase of the end of the book of Exodus, by the way. It was always so. The cloud covered it, appearing as fire by night. Whenever the cloud lifted from the tent, the Israelites would set out accordingly. And at the spot where the cloud settled, there the Israelites would make camp. Because of that verse 17, that's why this whole paragraph is there. Because it's about how they're going to walk through the desert and how are they going to walk following the cloud. We don't have to read the rest of that chapter. It says the same thing 5, 6, 7 times. Just to make sure everyone knows where it is. And then chapter 10, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, have 2 silver trumpets made them of hammered work. I think we mentioned this. And that tells us in the coming verses, the trumpets are to announce to the camp when we're on our way, when they should get up and start walking. And then it talks about other uses of the trumpets, but that is the basic function of the trumpets. And that brings us to chapter 10, verse 11. In the second year, on the 20th day of the second month, which is only 5 days after a date we've already heard, because the second Passover, Pesach Sheni, was the 14th and 15th of the second month of the second year. So it's only 5 days later. They finished keeping the Passover, and the cloud lifted from the Tabernacle of the Pact, and their Israelites set forth on their journeys from the wilderness of Sinai. That's it. We've been waiting for this moment for the last six classes. And just let me ask everyone, see who remembers.
What's the difference between Sinai and Paran?
There are two different areas in the desert, but they're all within what we call today the Sinai Desert, most probably. So let's ask a question now. Now that they're leaving Mount Sinai, when did they get there? And how long have they been there?
Significance to the number?
No, it's not anything. It's not a trick question. It's not a deep... No. So let me remind everyone. They got there 50 days after leaving Egypt. I should be more careful. It's actually 43 days. Right? The Torah was received 50 days after leaving Egypt, but they got to Mount Sinai 43 days after leaving Egypt, which was chapter 19 of the book of Exodus. So from chapter 19 of the book of Exodus until chapter 10 of the book of Numbers, and that includes, of course, all of Leviticus in the middle, they're in the same place, right? To remember that they're all in the same place. They're encamped at Mount Sinai, and they finally start leaving there in the second year, on the 20th day of the second month. And the rest of these verses in chapter 10 are about the beginning of the march. We don't have to read all the verses about how they took the camp apart and they began the march. Let's go to verse 29. Moses said to Hovav, son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, "We're setting out for the place of which the Lord has said, I will give it to you. Come with us and we will be generous with you, for the Lord has promised to be generous to Israel." So as they're leaving, they say to Moses' father-in-law, who's been there most probably again since the Jews themselves, the Israelites themselves, got to Mount Sinai. In the verses in chapter 19 of Exodus, it says that he got there. Remember, he brought Moses' wife with him and Moses' kids, who hadn't seen them since before the Exodus. So Moses says, "We're going, you want to come with us?" And it looks like he said, "I will not go." He replied to them, "But I will return to my native land." He said, "Please do not leave us, inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness and can be our guide. So if you come with us, we will extend to you the same bounty the Lord grants us." Okay, so he decides not to come. I remember talking about this, I don't know if it was a year ago or 6 years ago. We won't talk about it again. But I just want to point out that there's something a little bit strange in verse 31, and we might or might not get to it in another 3 or 4 weeks. In verse 31 of chapter 10, what I just read. Moses says, "Please do not leave us," he says to his father-in-law, "inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness and can be our guide." The literal words in Hebrew are, "You can be our eyes." Does anyone see what's really strange and unexpected and incongruous about this verse?
What verse?
Well, to me, it's just simply supposing they're being led by Hashem. So
right.
Why do they need a guide?
Right.
I mean, he should know the territory.
Right. Right. It's very strange. And the truth is that whenever we talked about this a year ago or 6 years ago, I don't remember, I gave an answer to that question by way of drash, by way of sermonizing. But if we ask the question on the level of the simple meaning of the Torah, it's a good question, and the answer is not obvious. Why does Moses say this?
Could it be he's given him something to do?
Because we don't really need you, but just to make you feel better.
Well, he wants him to come with him, right?
Right.
So he's looking for some leverage to say, we need you.
That's nice.
What about local knowledge? What about being the only in the area?
Well, if they're being led by the cloud of God, then God knows better than
saying,
a guide.
I'm just saying, I'm not thinking in a very spiritual, I'm just saying, I don't know.
Yeah.
Practically.
I guess they need all the help they can get.
But again, if God, is God, then who needs any assistance?
Did they have the mindset then that God is involved in the minutiae?
Well, it just said in the verse we read just a few seconds ago that whenever the cloud lifts, they start walking and they follow the cloud until the cloud sets down and then they're finished. What else do you need?
Yeah.
So I don't have an answer, but this might seem to be a little bit parallel to things that happen later in the book of Numbers, when the people are shown to be lacking in faith in God. As it were, perhaps Moses is lacking in faith in God. And perhaps this is really setting up a paradigm of future sins. But we might or might not talk about that another 3 weeks.
Well, he just said something that sort of set me off, because I'm really a neophyte to this study. So how local this God is sort of shocking to me as a newbie to the specifics of it, you know. Is a total monotheist, and you know, this thing of the whole world and creation. I mean, this guy's deal working in like a 5 mile radius or something like this for a lot of it. It just
you're right,
a little shocking to me.
You're right.
And then he's getting involved in what you just said, some real minutia of specifics. Is there any conversation about that at all, or things, or you know, it's almost like he's
even beyond this journey, but just in general that period of time. Or,
well, has there been any commentary? I mean, this is the God of the universe, the world, creation, and you're going on and on about he's in the tent and he's this and he's getting involved with you know, all sorts of little things, and the horns you're going to blow, and you know, you're going to journey out 15 miles, and he's, you know,
didn't make a right turn.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Has there been any thinking about, is that reduced God? Why was that? Did it change? I mean, it just seems like some big questions are being put, because to me, it's sort of shocking to me that this is the story. I mean, I didn't, you know, realize it.
What you're saying is all true, and it's an important point to make. I'll say something.
But I kind of disagree with Fred. You can look at it from the angle, if he can micromanage everything there, he is omnipotent beyond omnipotent, that he can just manage it all. I don't know that I look at it that this is only where he is. It's how thorough he can be wherever he is.
Well, you can say that, but to me this is like the original monotheistic concept was awful local, and maybe an expanded in time or tradition or something, but this was a much smaller concept than I had in, you know, than I thought I would come across, so to speak.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you agree with what you're saying, there must be some commentary on this thought process somewhere, right?
So what you're pointing out really can be subsumed under the expression anthropomorphism, right? Relating to God and talking about God as we talk about a human being. And the truth is that God seems to be described pretty much in terms similar to a human being. God comes and God goes, and God talks, God appears, God is in a certain place, God gets angry. It seems pretty human. That's what we call anthropomorphism. And I'll just tell you that I'm in dialogue with a few Muslim leaders in Dallas, and in a theological dialogue that took place only a few weeks ago, one of the Muslim leaders pointed out to me that they see their religion as much, much purer than Judaism. He said to me something like, Judaism is monotheistic. It's not as pure monotheism. It's not as pure God of the Spirit as Islam is. Islam, the Quran, has no anthropomorphism at all. Right? The Quran doesn't describe God in any terms. It's God talking to Muhammad. But everything that's written there is not about what God is.
Well, except then they create this semi-god in Muhammad.
Muhammad's a prophet in Islam. He's not a god. He's like Moses. So question is a question. So there's so much I can say. One thing is that if you look into the Torah with unprejudiced eyes, the question becomes even stronger, because the Torah really never says that God is omniscient. It never says that.
No.
That's later Jewish philosophy that teased that out of the Torah and the Tanakh. But the truth is, God is pretty local in the Torah. Now, it's not that he's only local. Let me give you an example. In the book of Leviticus, I think we discussed this once in the past, in the book of Leviticus, God seems to be described as coming down and dwelling in the tabernacle. In the book of Deuteronomy, God is described as in heaven and his name is in the tabernacle. And that really, Fred, is a effort perhaps to grapple with what you bring up. God is not really limited to the tabernacle, only his name. That's where he puts out his shingle. It represents, it's a place that you can knock on the door to talk to him, but he's not really there, he's in heaven. And that description of God in Deuteronomy as being in heaven, only his name is in the tabernacle, that's part of the opening up and the widening and the universalizing of the concept of God, I think. And in the end, what we come out with is an approach that has two poles to it. And the way I like to think about it is to use the Shema Yisrael prayer as a description of these two poles. We say Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Three pieces to that statement. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. One way to understand it that the Midrash talks about, we're making two statements about God that stand in tension. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. To say the Lord our God is our God, is God is the particular God and guardian of the Jewish people. To say the Lord is one is to say there's only one force that rules all of heaven and earth. So what we're doing is we are taking hold of the particular and the universal at the same time. And we're stating God is particular to the Jewish people, at the same time God is universal to the whole world. And that really is the tension or the paradox that the Torah talks about. And what you're pointing out is just a specific example of that particularism that Torah is all about, that God, for some strange reason, has connected himself to the Jewish people and to all the particulars of the life of the Jewish people, but that doesn't contradict the fact that he is also the God, the one God of the whole universe at the same time.
Let me ask you a question, because you reach out to these other groups and things like that. Do you think the Old Testament sort of left a big hole that when you have the New Testament, God truly became within the New Testament, if you believe it, you know, he gave his son to the whole world, basically. So now you have a book where he was pretty local to one, and I'm not sure anywhere it says, I go beyond the Jews, I'm the God of the Jews and you. So we have God for ourselves, so to speak. The whole world's missing out. It seems like it created a big hole that the New Testament sort of opened up. I mean, if I'm a non-Jew, mm-hmm. I'm going to feel a lot better about now I've mm-hmm. got a God mm-hmm. for everybody that's universal as opposed to the God here. And, mm-hmm. and it, does it ever really expand where he becomes the God of everybody? I mean, can you see the hole that people yeah, would be yeah, left with yeah. if you're left
absolutely,
with the Old,
absolutely.
The Old Testament?
Absolutely. What you're saying is a good point. Let me just put it in context. In chapter 12 of... First of all, of course, the Torah begins with the creation of the world. And God seems to work with the whole world until things don't work out once and then again, and God decides to focus on one family, on Avraham. But it says at the beginning of the election of Avraham that v'nivrachu v'cha kol mishpachot adama, all the nations of the world will be blessed through you. And the philosophy seems to be that God has chosen Abraham to be an example to the rest of the world. This nation is chosen to live on a higher level of godliness, morality, etc. But the ultimate idea is that it's not for the purpose of the benefit of the Jewish people. It's the Jewish people to serve as a light unto the nations. In the language of Isaiah, the language of Exodus chapter 19, to be a kingdom of priests who minister to the world. So the idea is there. But it doesn't say what is the rest of the world supposed to do except see the Jews as a light. And then indeed, Christianity provides a monotheistic framework which, in the eyes of many Jewish thinkers, is actually fleshing out what non-Jews can do to serve God. In other words, Judaism doesn't have to see Christianity as an enemy, but rather the opposite, as a helpmate. Judaism is for Jews, and Christianity is a certain Judaism for non-Jews.
Because in civilization at the time, because I think Constantinople was like 319 or something like that.
Constantine.
But the big event was 319 or
when he converted to Christianity.
So you mean? He converted. So you had the Roman gods before that, right?
Yeah.
Which was still more universal. And then you had, and then Christianity sort of gave the universality in a more monotheistic way to the rest of the world. You can sort of see the hole that the Old Testament sort of left, that this filled. I mean, it's a natural power void, so to speak, that, you know, water, you know, things always go into the void or something like that. It just sort of, I don't know, it sort of makes more sense to me and seeing what happens. So
I'll just add that around the time of Jesus, some historic demographers point out that there may have been over 10 million people in the world who were semi-converts to Judaism. Meaning that the Roman Empire was ripe for some type of religious revolution, and Judaism could not be a religion for the masses because of its demands, but there were perhaps 10 million who became what's called either Sabbath observers or God-fearers, who latched onto Judaism to some degree. And in the end, many of them became Christian. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for that.
I didn't mean to get you off, but
it's interesting. It's important.
My head with
no, that was interesting.
So we're going to go on now to chapter 11. We're going to spend the rest of the time on the first three verses of chapter 11 of the book of Numbers. So I'm going to read them slowly. Chapter 11 of the book of Numbers. The people took to complaining bitterly before the Lord. So immediately the journey to the land of Israel begins, and the first thing we hear about is a complaint. And I think I mentioned that actually the only things that the Torah describes of the content of the journey is this list of seven complaints, which is, now it's just complaining. The Lord heard and was incensed. A fire of the Lord broke out against them, ravaging the outskirts of the camp. The people cried out to Moshe. Moshe prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. That place was named Tavera, which means fire, burning, because the fire of the Lord had broken out against them. Okay, so this is problematic, because it doesn't say, they complained, but what did they say? What actually is wrong with their complaint? What was so terrible that they had to be killed? A fire ravaged people. And what is this matter of the outskirts of the camp? Is it just a geographical location? If it is, then why did the people on the outskirts get punished more than the people inside the camp? What's wrong there? So it's pretty ambiguous. I want to focus today on Rashi's interpretation, Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, in France in the 10th, 11th centuries. And on the sheet, I brought Rashi. By the way, in the Hebrew, it looks like for some reason my program change the order of the words. It should be B'Ktzei HaMachaneh if you're looking at the Hebrew. That's the language of the Torah that's translated as the outskirts of the camp, the edge of the camp, and says Rashi, those who were distinguishable because of their lowliness, these were the mixed multitude. Rabbi Shimon ben Menashe says, the most distinguished among them and the most prominent. And Rashi is quoting from a midrash. So let's try and understand what's going on here. It says, Biktzei HaMachaneh, the outskirts of the camp. And Rashi says to himself, is it just describing something geographical? That can't be, because what's special about that place? What did the people in that area do wrong with another place? It should tell us something. So he understands it's not geographical, it's sociological. It's the people on the outskirts of the camp as far as their social status, not as far as where they are on the ground, but where they are on the social ladder. And he gives two possibilities. We're talking about people on the outskirts of the camp as far as the social ladder goes, but which outskirt? Is it the top or is it the bottom of the ladder? Is it the people at the lowest level or the people at the highest level? And both of them, of course, whether it's the social elite or the social downcast, they're on the outskirts of society. So Rashi's first interpretation is it's those who are the most lowly, meaning the mixed multitude. The mixed multitude, that's the description of the non-Israelites, whether it might have been Egyptians or Midianites, whoever, who latched themselves on to the camp and came with the Israelites when they left Egypt. The mixed multitude, and that's actually the prototype for the whole idea of conversion, that they became members of the camp. But here, Rashi is accusing them of being those who are complaining. They didn't have the history and the tradition of the Jewish people. And when things got tough, then they started to complain. And you can say that this might be an example of that type of thinking that always blames the outsiders for your problems. And well, there are certain commentators who blame the Erev Rav, the mixed multitude, for everything that goes wrong in the desert. But I don't want to focus on that. I want to focus on another possibility that Rashi said.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
We talked about that sort of in the same vein, because once when we learned something and we were talking about like the forefathers and foremothers, that they weren't these perfect specimens. Is that similar than the reason they blame them? It's easier to blame the non-Jew than the Jew and sanitize it so that your followers, is that sort
yes,
of the same
yes,
thing
yes,
I we
think
talked about?
That, yes, I think so. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Just check it.
That's a good point. But the other side of it is more interesting.
Was it prominent?
The most prominent people, they were the ones that went bad. And I want to actually spend the whole time on that possibility. And to try and think, the social elite, those at the top, why would they specifically the ones to complain, to go bad, to ruin it? So we'll talk about that for the whole next hour. Where is that going to bring us to? It's going to bring us to chapter 24 of Exodus. Now we're in for a roller coaster ride. Chapter 24 of the book of Exodus, verse 1. We won't go back to Numbers for quite a while. For another 40 minutes, we won't go back to the book of Numbers. We're in chapter 4 of the book of Exodus. Chapter 24. 24 of the book of Exodus. And this is someplace around the giving of the Ten Commandments. Might be right after. It's really not clear chronologically. We're going to read verses 1 to 2 and then 9 to 14. Then he said to Moshe, this is God speaking, come up to the Lord with Aaron, Nadav, and Avihu, and 70 elders of Israel, and bow low from afar. The come up is Mount Sinai. Moses alone shall come near to the Lord, but the others shall not come near, nor shall the people come up with him. So three stations are going to be developed here. The people stay at the bottom of the mountain. The elders, 72 of them, go up the mountain but don't go to the top. And only Moses goes to the top. Now verse 9, it plays itself out. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, and 70 elders of Israel ascended. So they started up towards God at the top of the mountain. And they saw the God of Israel. That's really what it says in Hebrew. Under his feet, talking about anthropomorphism, right, Fred? Under his feet, that's the feet of God. There was the likeness of a pavement of sapphire, like the very sky, for purity. Yet he did not raise his hand against the leaders of the Israelites. They beheld God, and they ate and drank. The Lord said to Moshe, come up to me on the mountain and wait there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the teachings and commandments which I have inscribed to instruct you. So in other words, the elders are going to stay midway up the mountain, and Moses has said to them, come up to the top. So Moses and attendant Yeshua arose, and Moses ascended to the mountain of God. To the elders he said, wait here for us till we return. You have Aaron and Hor with you. Let anyone who has a legal matter approach them. Fine.
I just want to clarify. So this whole concept you're not allowed to look at God is false?
We're going to get to it right now. Get to it right now.
Mm-hmm. Simon, I grew up with that. You couldn't gaze on him or something like
of
that.
Of course, of course. Okay. And that's exactly what I'm about to say. As you look on the sheet in C2A1, in the last fourth, Exodus 33, verse 20 says, no man shall see me and live. And in Exodus 33, verse 20, when God says, lo yirani adam v'chai, lo man shall see me and live, he says it to Moses. In other words, even Moses cannot see God. And that's the idea of God's otherness, God's transcendence, God's energy and power, that were a man to see him, he would blow up, he would explode, implode in a ball of energy. Or perhaps you'd say that you just can't see anything because it's so other, it's so beyond, it's so transcendent, it's not visible. You can't understand, you can't come close, you can't touch, you can't see, you can't feel. It's just something else, it's transcendent. But here it says that they saw God, and it says it twice. In Hebrew, it's two different words. It says it in verse 10, they saw God, and it says in verse 11, they beheld God. Two different verbs, but they mean the same thing. It emphasizes that they saw God, and that's, of course, very, very troubling. It's troubling not just from a theological point of view, it contradicts Exodus 33, where it says, no man can see me and live, not even Moses. And that's not the only problem, the only issue with these verses, but notice also the strange wording of verse 11. Yet he did not raise his hand against the leaders.
He being God.
He meaning God. Why would it say that God did not strike them down?
Because he violated that covenant, but they didn't. But he let them do it.
That's what it sounds like. It sounds like it's hinting to us they did something wrong. Mm-hmm. That's what Rashi's going to say in another minute.
Well, I mean, that doesn't mean there's not a better time or a better place to make a point.
Explain to me what you mean.
Well, sometimes, you know, a lesson can be taught at a better time than at that moment.
Ah, exactly.
I mean, yeah. The dog, they tell you to do it right then and there.
But wait, it takes two to tango, so you let them look at them.
Ah, okay, so that'll... Wait a second, just okay, very good, very good.
So
but wait for Rashi to deal with that, but that's a good point. In other words...
That God should be able to keep himself invisible.
They didn't like sneak up on him and look at him, and he said, I'll let you get away with it. He told him to come up and let him look at him, so he had something in mind here.
Okay, I'll wait a minute with that. I just want to point out one more difficulty with these verses, which is the very end of verse 11. They beheld God, and they ate and drank. And one possible way of looking at it is saying, wait a second. If you're involved in something so spiritual, so transcendent as gazing on God, if it's possible, can you eat and drink at the same time? So with those three issues in mind, can they see God versus say you can't? Why does it say that God didn't raise his hand? Does it mean that God could have raised his hand against them? And this eating and drinking, through those three points, read Rashi to a very different interpretation of these verses than what we might have expected. So I brought Rashi on the sheet, and Rashi says, the very bottom of the page, last five lines, they gazed and peered and were sentenced to die.
It's pretty severe.
And then Rashi says what Leslie said, but the Holy One, blessed be He, did not want to disturb the rejoicing of this moment of the giving of the Torah, so He waited for Nadav and Avihu to kill them until the day of the dedication of the Mishkan. And you know what that means. That's Leviticus chapter 9 or 10, I can't remember. And for the death of the elders until the following incident. And the people were as if seeking complaints, and a fire of the Lord broke out against them and devoured at the edge of the camp, Numbers 11:1. Recognize that?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Now, there's Rashi's connecting between our verses in the book of Numbers and the verses right here. And he's saying that in the book of Numbers, when those people at the edge of the camp, we said at the sociological high rung of the ladder, when they were punished for their complaint, they really were being punished for something they did not only then in Numbers, but they were being punished for something they did back in the book of Exodus. And I suppose what Rashi is saying, that it's the same type of mistake, the same type of sin, the same type of transgression. In other words, if we figure out what they did wrong here in Exodus, we'll know what they did wrong in Numbers. It's really the same phenomena.
Well, let me ask you a question. Don't you find that weak, in your opinion? I mean, he's connecting things that, first of all, God invites them up and lets them look at it. So the question of whether they did anything wrong, like you have where he said, don't look back or you'll turn to a pillar of salt, that's clearly wrong. He's, you know, you violated something. This doesn't seem to be anything wrong. And then the other thing was connected to a completely different incident, the complaint. So he's just, some people died involved with God, so he's just connecting it somehow to create a point. It just seems like, if I'm a real scholar, it seems like a weak point that a lot of other scholars would reject.
Okay.
In terms of,
so I'll relate to what you said, and I'll actually admit there's a lot of truth in what you're saying, but I'll go back. First of all, I think that what Rashi is telling us is that when it says that they saw God, it means they thought they saw God. Because really, no man can see me and live.
He's already said that.
He says it later, but it's all the same, right? No man can see me and live. They went up the mountain, and these are the leaders of the Jewish people, Israelites. They have great purity. They have a great connection to God. They love God. They want to connect to God. And in their spirituality, in their religiosity, they go overboard. They overstep the boundaries. They have a spiritual experience which is based just as much on their subjective yearning to have that experience as it's based on any type of objective reality. No man can see me and live. They went up the mountain, and it's God's mountain, this is Mount Sinai, and they're really close to God, and they experience themselves as seeing God. But no man can see me and live. I almost want to say metaphorical. It's trying to tell us something about the dangers of spirituality. It's trying to tell us something about the dangers of closeness to transcendence. And of course, the danger is only found among the elite, only those who have the wherewithal to approach God. They are most susceptible to the subjective illusion of seeing God. Again, what does seeing God stand for? It stands for some type of experience, some type of knowledge, some type of religious nirvana, expanding of consciousness, widening of boundaries. And they felt that they had it. They grasped what that experience is. And the Torah tells us that is punishable. That's an amazing point.
Also with the fear, and, you know, a fearful God and a loving God. You know, the...
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, the different aspects.
Right. These are really themes we've talked about in the past. That the, on the one hand, let's use Leslie's language. On the one hand, the Torah talks about in the book of Deuteronomy, love of God, which is about coming close. It's about understanding. It's about identifying. It's about all those positive things. But the Torah also talks about the fear of God, and the book of Leviticus and the book of Numbers emphasize again and again, you have to keep your distance. There's, and again, it's the same idea. There's a danger to coming too close. Now, you can talk about the danger in physical terms. You'll be imploded. You'll come near the divine energy, and you'll lose your consciousness. You'll lose your sense of individuality. Yes, but here, it's not just... it's also punishable. Now, if we ask, why is it punishable? Okay, so they think they saw God, and they had a wonderful religious experience, and they're going to be on cloud nine for the rest of their lives. So what's wrong with it? What's really wrong with it? I'm not sure if I want to answer that question now or later.
I was thinking about the prior experiences where human beings came into contact. Prior to this incident, are there consistent behaviors when a human being really interacts with God? So my case, then my question would be, is the behavior here seems inconsistent? Is that inconsistent with all prior or in a holy place? So this seems, when I read it, it seemed a very almost cavalier, not casual, as opposed to you were in a very experience.
Yes.
That's what really struck me about the passage. Because you're about to get the Torah, and you would think it's the most holy, one of the most holy experiences in humanity. They said what they were reading, but they were drinking.
Yeah, but you're saying right. You're right.
So I don't understand. It seemed almost inconsistent with every prior experiences that human beings truly interacting with Hashem.
So you're right. In the book of Genesis, as far as I remember, there's a lot about hearing God, but it's not about seeing God.
Right.
And hearing is a mode of communication that maintains a certain degree of distance. And it's non-tangible. Seeing is a mode of communication that creates a deeper level of closeness and has an image involved. It's much more tangible. And that's why the Torah emphasizes you can't see God. Perhaps you can hear Him, but you can't see Him. In other words, it's a boundary. It's a boundary.
But also God has sent messengers.
You can see the messenger, but you can't see God. And just let me remind everyone that there are things we can see, but what you can see, fire, a burning bush, the fire at the top of the mountain. And the fire again symbolizes something you have to maintain a distance from, something that's not completely tangible, something that's always amorphous and changing. It's about a metaphor for something beyond and something other. You about to say something, Fred?
Well, following his point, even beyond that, Moses is involved in all this. So Moses is with the elders. So Moses is now seeing, you know, you have, like you're saying, the burning bush, which you're not actually, you're saying the Spirit of God or something. Now Moses is actually seeing God, and he's coming forward from where the elders are and going off.
It's a good point.
So
good
this
point.
Has even gone way beyond anything.
Okay, I had not thought of what you're saying.
Yeah.
But apparently, according to Rashi, we have to say that Moses and Aaron didn't see God. Only Nadav and Avihu and the 70 elders did. Because Moses was not punished and Aaron was not punished. Right, that's what you'd have to say. But that's a good point. The text doesn't say that, but you'd have to say that. So, let me just see if there's anything else we want to say here.
Well, there's one last point. You're connecting still the fire with a lot of this, right? And to me, if I was, say, analyzing this, say, like, as an English major or something, there's a big point, it seems to me, that's being missed, which is the issue of the complaint. And the issue of complaint, which is that we're sort of forging a new society here. So you've got the issue that God is saying by the complaints, those people are almost not willing to go forward with the new society God is leading them to, because they're saying it was better back in Egypt, this, that, and the other thing. So he's killing off, in essence, those people who aren't really willing to go create the new society to some extent. That seems to be a real theme that we're not discussing in terms of why is saying I'm not being fed as well, or I'm not being so-and-so is getting them so mad, so to speak.
Okay.
And it's really almost a rejection of, in some ways, the new world or the whole concept of the journey that he's leading them on, And that's why he's killing these people. Well, if they're not worthy of the journey, they're not the people who will go into the land. Is that ever addressed in any way? Because that seems to be a major theme or point.
In the three verses we read in the book of Numbers, it doesn't yet talk about the specific complaint that you mentioned. That comes later. Here in these three verses, it just said that they complained. Doesn't say about what. But now let me relate to what you said, and it brings us back to the question, so what's wrong with this overdose of spirituality? Why are they punishable, these elders who saw God or thought they saw God? And I think there's an answer to that, and it relates to the complaints that we saw in the book of Numbers. I'll just tell you a short story. I was having lunch today. Anyone ever hear of Dr. Robert Hunt? He's a theologian. He's the head of world religions at SMU. So we're having lunch today, and we're talking about interfaith dialogue. And he said the following sentence to me. We were talking about different Muslim groups, and he mentioned the Sufis, the Muslim mystics. And he said to me, you know, the Sufis in Dallas, they hardly consider themselves even Muslims, and they can talk to anyone. They talk to the Christian mystics, and it's almost not Christians talking to Muslims, it's just mystics talking to mystics. And when Dr. Hunt says that mystics can always talk to mystics, no matter what religion they are, that might have the key to understanding what's going on in these verses. Because the tendency of mysticism, when I say mysticism, I mean what we're talking about here, that search for the direct connection to God, the being absorbed in the Godhead, the seeing God. Mysticism tends to chafe against and ultimately transcend institutions of individual religions, and the truth is, institutions of society in general. Mystics, they don't really need not only our buildings and our churches or synagogues or mosques, they don't need our governments. They don't need our aid societies. They don't need JCC, and they don't need it. They don't need government. They don't need anything, because mystics remove themselves from this world and transcend the physical world. And from the point of view of any government and the point of view of any society, as beautiful as the spirituality of mysticism is, it's extremely dangerous to the foundations of society, because mystics tend to be almost anarchists and certainly antinomian. Antinomian is against law. They don't need law. They don't function within the boundaries of law. They're just involved with God all day. And here, in the book of Numbers, truth is in the whole Torah, but especially in the book of Numbers, we're involved in Moses trying to build the foundations of a civil society. He's trying to build a society that's, yes, based on divine law, but it's about tikkun olam. It's about making a human society that functions on the basis of laws that people will follow in order to create a better world. And the last thing you need are mystics who have no need for the improvement of society, because they're beyond society. And the Torah in general, therefore, has a dim view of mysticism, of spirituality. Now, I said that too strongly. Spirituality is a beautiful thing. Trying to come close to God is a beautiful thing. But in the Torah, it always has to be connected to this world, to the physical world, to the commands of do's and don'ts for building institutions, for building a just society. And when you have people who, in their spiritual longings for the truth, no longer have a need for the institutions of society, it's a problem. Livriot. It's a problem.
But you're equating the complainers to mystics?
According to Rashi, in this particular instance of the three verses in the book of Numbers. There are other complaints of other people who we get to next week and the week after and the week after.
But they were complaining like they were being fed better in Egypt.
No, that comes later. We just read three verses about...
This was just Nadav and...
Let's just read again in Numbers chapter 11, verses 1 to 3. That's all. Later it talks about other complaints. But this particular complaint just says they're complaining, they got zapped by God, then it goes on to something else. So according to Rashi, their complaint had nothing to do with food. It doesn't say what their complaint was, but we should understand from Rashi, the complaint, whatever it was, is based upon their lack of concern, their lack of interest with building society. They just want to be with God. And paradoxically, even when you're building a divine society, you don't need people who just want to be with God. You need people that want to be in this world according to God's command. So at least according to Rashi, that's what's going on here, I think.
I mean, is it possible that we're talking about that they're equating it was better in the old place?
But Fred, that doesn't say that.
If you say that, then they're not accepting independence of the Jewish people. So it's really a whole independence thing of I'm building the Jewish people now as a separate people, as a mighty people, as my chosen people. And these planes are bringing you back to Egypt, are bringing you back to being part of another society in their anti-state, basically.
But again, that could come up later when it says we want to go back to Egypt. But in this particular complaint, it doesn't say that.
Is there ever a complaint in the Torah that's not about, where they ever mention a specific complaint anywhere, it's not about we're not being fed, we're cold, we're this, it was better there. Anything right. That's ever stated, is it anything other than that?
There's the complaint of Korah, which is against Moses for usurping power and lording it over us. Right?
Okay. There was a complaint when Moses struck the rock, they were thirsty.
Then it was water. They wanted water, like Fred said, right? That is a lot of. We want food, we want water, we want to go back to Egypt.
Comfort.
That exists.
I'm just saying, we don't know what the complaint was. Correct.
And Rashi is trying to figure it out for us. It doesn't say.
So the only thing that we can infer a lot of different things of complaining. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about the verse is it's very clear that it displeased God. It's not like he heard. It's sort of like the crying of you know, when they were in Egypt, and then it was over a long period of time, and he heard. I mean, it was very quick. That's what strikes me. They complained that he was displeased, and then there was a fire. Mm-hmm. There's no that wonderful quality of God is he's a very patient God, and he hears and he listens. In this verse, it wasn't like that at all.
You're
he was
right.
Pleased.
Except that Rashi actually gives an answer to what you're saying, because Rashi says it's the third time they did it. Right? According to Rashi. Turning to Rashi.
Right.
Everybody's patience.
It's like the old saying, God give me patience and please hurry, right? So I don't know if it was three times in a minute, three times over a long, I don't know. But it just strikes me that it was very...
But again, there are many issues and questions, and you brought up another one with these three verses and numbers. Rashi is trying to give us answers, and it turns out that Rashi's answer actually also answers your matter by saying it's really the third time. I just want to point out, perhaps I'm hitting a dead horse over the head, but to me it's an important point that Rashi wants to tell us that a focus on too much spirituality is just as bad as a focus on too many leeks and onions. Right? Too much physicality, as we'll get to the later complaints. But you, just like you can't build a just society with people who just want their onions and the leeks, you also can't build a just society with people who only want their God. Okay, so...
Right.
Say it again, please.
It's the whole moderation.
The whole moderation thing again.
There's got to be a balance.
That's true. That's true.
Which causes a friction.
Mm-hmm.
And where did you say these complaints first came up?
Well, I didn't say, but beginning right now in the book of Numbers, we're going to read this list of seven complaints. The first one we saw right now.
Number, chapter 11, number 4, they're complaining about...
Yeah, but we didn't get to that yet.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
We're in the first three verses. I agree that later on, next week, there'll be complaints about the leeks and the onions.
Literally.
Literally, yeah. So now...
Come next week.
It's called a teaser.
So what we've seen is that at Mount Sinai, we have the 70 elders and Nadav and Avihu that are accused of seeing God. They cross the boundaries and they're going to be punished, but not here. The 70 elders are punished in the book of Numbers, according to Rashi. And when are Nadav and Avihu punished? In the book of Leviticus. So let's just go there. In the book of Leviticus, what is it, chapter 10, the very beginning of chapter 10.
Can I just ask one thing? You're giving us Rashi. Is there, because I think it's a weak explanation. Are you leaving out others who might have alternate explanations that we're only getting one side of the story? Or is there others who don't?
There's always other sides of the story. There's always other sides of the story.
Are there any major things we're not hearing that have a whole different interpretation?
Okay, so the truth is that there are certainly commentators that look at these verses in the book of Exodus that said they saw God and they ate and they drank. Commentators that do not criticize, like Rashi does, do not say that they overstepped their boundaries. That's for one. And then in the book of Numbers, who are these complainers? I didn't look at other commentators. I know this Rashi from a long, long time ago, and it's very deep in my mind.
Would Rashi be the most common accepted version, or, you know, how would you put him on this continuum?
Rashi, by dint of being Rashi, is the prince of Bible commentators. But I'm not going to tell you that you have to accept Rashi. I'll just tell you a story. It's not a story. In the world of traditional Jewish learning and scholarship, there is a perspective, and it's certainly the primary perspective in what's called the Haredi world, the ultra-Orthodox world, that you can't learn the five books of Moses without Rashi. It's like reading every other verse. You have to read it with Rashi. And in the end, you might find other commentators that disagree with Rashi, but you first have to see Rashi as the baseline. I learned differently. My teachers taught me that you first should look at the Torah with unprejudiced eyes, and then look at different commentators. Certainly Rashi is very important. You should take him seriously. And you know, in this class, I usually don't bring Rashi. We just look at the Torah in a straightforward, unadulterated fashion. I thought I should mix it up a little bit and show you a perspective reading it through Rashi's eyes. This particular Rashi, I think, is meaningful. It might not be the straightforward meaning of the text, but it teaches a deep lesson. I think that's very important. And also, it might be the straightforward meaning of the text. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I'm not saying that I'm sure one way or the other. Right? But it certainly is something to show us.
Well, who are the second and third commentators that everyone looks to?
After Rashi, I would say that you look to the Ramban, Nachmanides. And after Nachmanides, then it's a toss-up. You look at the Ibn Ezra, you look at the Sforno. Those four, Rashi, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, and Sforno, all Middle Age commentaries.
Okay, so what does the Ramban say about them looking
at Ramban.
Ramban, okay.
I didn't look.
What?
I didn't look. No.
Okay.
I can't look at everything.
They have a commentary down there. You should look at the...
Yeah, the Art Scroll brings some of the major commentaries.
Down
okay.
There.
Now, I noticed you had our favorite, Rabbi Kukor.
We're not going to get to it.
Oh, he's our most favorite guy.
But I was thinking of you, absolutely, when I put it there. Absolutely. So just let me say one more thing in answer to what Fred brought up, is that in the traditional printing of the five books of Moses, the Chumash, the text is printed on the same page with Rashi, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, and Sforno, those four major commentators. There are other editions that have different commentators, but those are just about always there on the page. Okay, now we lost Fred. He's back. He's at the bottom of the page in the commentators. See you later, Fred. Okay, but in any case, we're going to look at Rashi.
Well, it says the Ramban accepted that they weren't punished.
The Ramban.
Ramban, yes. It says okay. He
accepted
they were not.
Great. Okay, so you see that there's pluralism in understanding Torah, of course. Leviticus chapter 10. Leviticus chapter 10 is at the pinnacle of the spiritual experience of the Jewish people. The tabernacle has just been dedicated. The 7-day ceremony, and then the 8th day is when the fire comes out from heaven and consumes the sacrifices on the altar. And in the wake of that comes chapter 10, at this great moment of spiritual exaltation. Now Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu, each took his fire pan, put fire in it, and laid incense on it, and they offered before the Lord alien fire which he had not enjoined upon them. And fire came forth from the Lord and consumed them, thus they died at the instance of the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord meant when he said, through those near to me I show myself holy and gain glory before all the people. So there's this great moment when the whole all of Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, is rejoicing at the closeness to God. Those two sons of Aaron take it one step further. They go straight into God with their incense pan and they're burned to a crisp. And on this we're going to read what Rashi says. Back to my sheet. Rashi says, Rabbi Elazar says, he's quoting from a Midrash, as he always does, Aaron's sons died only because they rendered halachic decisions in the presence of Moses, their teacher. Rabbi Yishmael says they died because they entered the sanctuary after having drunk wine. Now, it seems to me clear that this Rashi is a statement of a overarching principle in halachic language. What does it mean that they rendered halachic decisions in the presence of Moses, their teacher? Well, literally, that means that here I am standing next to Moses, and someone comes up to Moses and asks him a question of what to do, and I answer in place of Moses. And that's why they were killed. Now, don't take that literally. Rather, there's a principle involved here. And the principle seems to be what we've been talking about, that they broke down communal boundaries. They didn't know their place. They overstepped their boundaries. Look at the matter, Rabbi Yishmael says, in Rashi, they drank wine. Drinking wine symbolizes the removal of inhibitions, the removal of boundaries. What's going on is what we've been talking about for the past hour. Nadav and Avihu, in their great spirituality, in their greatness, they were great people. Because they were great, because they were so intoxicated by God, they went just one step further in their connection to God, and they was apt for it. It's a very fine line. Right? You should make every effort to come as close as you can to God. But one step too far, it's called seeing God when you can't see. It's called going where you shouldn't go. And it means being burned to a crisp because no man can see me and live. And the idea again is that ultimately those who are intoxicated by spirituality, they lose any sense of communal boundaries and any need for communal institutions. And they end up being antinomianists, if there's a word like that. I mean, against law, and anarchists. But who are we talking about? We're talking about the greatest people. We're not talking about the lowlifes. We're talking about the greatest people. But there's a great danger in being at such high level of religiosity and spirituality. Which reminds me of a really famous statement in the Babylonian Talmud in Tractate Sukkot that says the following. Perhaps we've discussed this, I don't remember. It says, as great as a man is, that's how great his evil impulse is. The greater the man, the greater the impulse. And to me, what that means, and it makes it clear later as the Talmud discusses it, there's really no such thing, at least according to this Talmudic passage, of an evil impulse and a good impulse. There's not an evil impulse and a good impulse. There's one impulse. We have an impulse for accomplishment. We have an impulse to make our mark on the world. We have an impulse to be powerful, to create. Some people have a weak impulse, some people have a strong impulse. Those people have the strongest impulse, they can be President of the United States. And it's that same impulse for greatness, for accomplishment, for creativity, for making your mark, for doing your thing. It's that same impulse for greatness that can become, if channeled improperly, an impulse for evil. And I always talk about Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. I wouldn't be capable of sinning the way Bill Clinton did. I'm not good enough. I'm not powerful enough. I don't have much charisma. It's only the man that has that tremendous charisma and power of creativity and leadership that could do such a stupid thing. I don't have the power to be so stupid.
Sin has been done before in a lot of lower levels, so that may not be the best.
Well, I'm not even on the level of those other people. I'd be too scared to sin. But there are people that can overcome their inhibitions. They're powerful. They have charisma. They have vision. They have creativity. And that's the point here. Nadav and Avihu were great people. They had this power of spirituality. But it's just a hair's breadth from sin. To say it differently, small people can accomplish small things and they can sin small sins. Greater people can make greater accomplishments and they can fall deeper. How do you say fall further? That's the way we say it.
So to me there's an important sentence here which sort of emphasizes your point, but maybe it's that it says that he had not commanded. So you've got this whole concept of I set the rules and you try to go outside the rules or improvise and you're burned to a crisp. So this is sort of in line with what you're saying, but it also sort of the whole concept maybe of total free will or something is being really challenged here, right? Versus the
not free will, but autonomy.
Yeah. But I mean, it seems to me those four words are pretty important in terms of the meaning of what
happened. Right. You can take this in different directions. You can take it as a statement that the ultimate value is only obedience. Where they weren't commanded, there's that. The Hasidic thinkers take it in a more nuanced fashion. That Nadav and Avihu were great men. And let's just read what Rashi brings. Now I see that Nadav and Avihu are greater than I or you. That's Moses talking to Aaron. The idea being that they were great. And their impulse for autonomy was important and good. But
they went too far.
Right? Don't just take it that obedience is the only value here. We're giving them great credit, but they just went one step too far. To put it in the language of the Me'ah Shiloach, it's a hair's breadth. It's just a hair's breadth. And I could really imagine that for Bill Clinton, it's just a hair's breadth. You know, when you have so much power and so much charisma and so much inner confidence, it's just a hair's breadth.
What was done that was so horrific?
They went where they shouldn't be. They went into the Holy of Holies, or into the Holy.
They knew ahead of time that that was not where they should be.
Good question. They weren't commanded to be there, and they should have known that in the sanctuary, in the tabernacle, it all goes according to boundaries. It all goes according to commands.
So that assumes that they obviously knew what they were doing.
There's even one commentator that says they willingly sacrificed themselves for God. They knew it was going to happen, but they just had to show how much they love God. They just had to do it.
That doesn't make sense to me.
I disagree. Zealots, that's what they
Well,
did.
I guess what came to mind was the notion of human sacrifice. That's what came
right.
to mind.
No, but think of the mystic who's just totally consumed by love of God. He knows it's going to destroy his personality. He's going to implode in the greatness of God, but he can't help himself.
I guess.
You're not a mystic.
No. I think it's a valid point. It's an experience that is beyond my comprehension.
I understand.
Well, Janice just said suicide bombers.
Yeah, I mean
they're not necessarily
mystics, but in their zealousness and fervor, they're going to go blow themselves up in the hopes that they'll reach their higher goal.
Right. And they end up being dangerous not only for their enemies but even for their friends.
Yes.
Because there's no boundaries.
I think part of this, the lesson is, it may seem like a little error that they made. I happen to think it wasn't worth getting from what they did. But that without these boundaries, the floodgates will open and everybody will be seeing God.
Is the word, it just strikes me, an alien fire been commented on. So fire is like power or something.
Here it's literal. They had fire in their frying pans.
Bringing in, but they call it an alien fire, not just fire. So they're making it as opposed to, I guess, God's fire or something.
Yeah, exact. When the incense is offered, as it's supposed to be on the altar, the fire for the incense is taken from the altar. Here, apparently, they took fire from a different place.
Right. So fire has a big symbolism in terms of... So is that significant in terms of their contradicting God's power somehow or rules?
I don't know. Okay. Fire and incense is one of the ways of serving God, but they did it in an uncommanded fashion.
All right.
So since it's late, we're not going to get to read the Mei HaShiloach that I wanted to read. I'll just tell you about it. The Mei HaShiloach is Rav Mordechai Liner. He died in, I think, 1849 or 59. He lived for 50, 60 years in the first half of the 19th century. He's what they call a radical thinker. And he, in the passage that we're not going to read, explains to us the deep, deep danger in what Nadav and Avihu did. And he says that the person who really does endeavor to approach God in the deepest sense, the person really involved in spirituality, mysticism, ultimately learns that everything is God. Everything in the world is God. And we are really just figments of God's imagination. We are marionettes in God's play. God controls everything. And once you reach the deep, mystical, spiritual conclusion that God is everywhere and God is everything and God controls everything, then you lose any sense of human responsibility. And you learn that you don't have to follow any rules, don't have to live according to any institutions, and there are no boundaries, because whatever you do, it's God's will. You're just a puppet in God's play. And free will and autonomy are a mirage. They're illusions. That's the conclusion that the mystic at the highest level comes to.
And does that create a contradiction in what we just read? That he's involved in the minutiae?
Yes. In other words, the person who reaches that level of spirituality becomes a danger to everything the Torah teaches. Everything. Because the Torah is ultimately not about spirituality. It's about creating rules and boundaries for a just society in this world. And the mystic can't take it. The mystic just can't live in that world. Because he says, what do you need rules for? Whatever I do, God must want me to do it. Whatever I do, wherever I go, whatever I think, it's all God. Such that the deepest mystical insight, which might be true, is the most dangerous thing for an ordered and meaningful human life. And the Mei HaShiloach says that if you want to search for mystical truth, you better be sure not to tell anyone what you learn. And you better be sure to be able to live on two levels at the same time. You might find that everything is God, but you have to be able to nuance that and at the same time follow the rules.
So
because mystics destroy society.
It doesn't hold out the enlightenment concept that, say, Indian...
In general, not. And again, the Mei HaShiloach is willing to say that for choice, select individuals, perhaps, but only if they're able to live on two levels and two worlds at once. And for me, the Mei HaShiloach, although he's a Hasid thinker who's not about the simple meaning of the Torah, he might actually be getting at what Rashi's been trying to tell us. That there's a terrible, terrible danger in the elite of society reaching spiritual enlightenment.
Right.
And they end up complaining against, right, that's the word in the book of Numbers, chapter 11, verse 1 to 3, complaining against all the institutions of society.
So if you're trying to ascend the spiritual ladder in Judaism as opposed to other religions, okay, where do you get to at the highest rung? Because as you were saying, if you go too far, as we call, like in Indian religion, enlightenment, you've reached the top, you've gone too far in Judaism, is what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Right? So enlightenment isn't the top of the ladder. It's what's the top of the ladder?
So,
true knowledge of the rules and total conformity. I mean, what is the top of the ladder?
Very good. Very good point you're making. And the whole school of Lithuanian Jewry, which called non-Hasidic Jewry, says that Judaism has no concept at all of spiritual enlightenment. It's just about intellectual knowledge of the Torah and its commandments. And keep the other stuff far from you. That's the non-Hasidic approach. The Hasidic approach and the mystical approach is much more nuanced. Search for that enlightenment, but have one foot on the ground. You have to have at least one foot on the ground.
Well, and you're also not supposed to do it till you're a certain level
yeah.
of maturity and wisdom, age.
Yeah.
So I guess that you that makes it a little bit easier, you know.
A little. Yeah.
Where does the Lithuanian come into that concept you just said?
We call Lithuanian Jewry, of course we're going back now 100 years in time, as the bastion of non-Hasidic Jewry, those who held out against the encroachment, the success of the Hasidic world.
But is that unique to Lithuania, the country Lithuania?
Not unique to it. Again, where Lithuania is today is not where it was 100 years ago. Boundaries were fluid there. But the phrase a Litvak means a Lithuanian Jew, someone who refuses to accept any of the spirituality of Hasidut.
I asked because my grandmother was from Lithuania, so that's why.
If she was from a family of Litvaks, or if there was an encroachment of Hasidut into our family, I don't know.
Okay, but that has nothing to do with the geographic region.
It did then,
okay.
But it doesn't today. Lexi, so yeah, it's probably time to end, so you'll have to look at Rav Kook on your own.
Well, we never as much fun.
Okay. So you're a firm believer in this concept, though, right?
I'm a firm believer in nuance and exploring different possibilities. What do you mean?
Yeah, you do need to come.
Of not going to true enlightenment, or that it's not the thing to go to, or it's not really possible, or it's not the mood.
I'm a Jew. What do you want? That's what I've been taught.
We're going to be ordained soon.
Oh, okay. There's different interpretations.
Yeah, but again, we all seem to agree within Judaism that ultimately you have to have at least one foot on the ground. Right? We don't want you up in a cave someplace in India or any place else. Because then you'll be fried to a crisp, either literally or figuratively in some sense.
Yeah.
That one foot on the ground is not the same analogy you always use when you say... You'll say something, you put one foot on the ground.
I don't know that phrase. What do you mean?